This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at the Champaign Aviation Museum in Ohio, their restoration work, the volunteers working on the aircraft, and how they see the role of an aviation museum. In the news, we look at 737 safety cards that are confusing some passengers, the scaled composites model 401, flight attendant trip brokering, Wow Air ending operations, and the 2018 Collier Trophy winner. We also give some first-hand impressions of the 2019 Sun and Fun Fly-In and Expo. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 548 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year. He's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Max West, we're back from Sun and Fun. Well, I'm not back, but you're back.
Yeah, I was thinking you said that I was joining you, and I was thinking, no, that was last week. I spent all week with you. How could I be joining you? We're now thousands of miles apart again.
Yes, we are. But you're back home, and I'm on the way home.
Indeed. Nice to be back here with you again.
Yes, absolutely. And also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, who was not at Sun and Fun this year. Hi, David.
That's right. I was not at Sun and Fun. Looks like everybody had a great time. It was nice having a week off, to be honest. So, but looking forward to a good show tonight.
Yeah, and I think you all listening may have heard the last episode here. What we did was when we were at Sun and Fun, myself and Max Trescott and Launchpad Merzari and Rob Mark got together and we recorded a show on Sun and Fun Radio. So, of course, that was broadcast live on the Sun and Fun AM radio station, as well as over at liveatc.net. And so what we did is we took the recording and just slapped an opening and a closing on it, put it up in the feed for you all to listen to. And Max Trescott, you had I thought, an interesting observation after we did that, which I agreed with, concerning how it felt to have that group together.
Boy, I don't remember the specific observation, but boy, yeah, it was great, great fun. I really enjoyed, you know, sitting across from you and Rob and Launchpad, and, you know, it just, what was the observation I made?
Yeah, you were saying about how, especially with respect to Rob, who we haven't, you know, had on the show in the same capacity for quite a while, and how it was just like old times, right? We just slid right into it and felt like we'd never been away for any length of time at all.
Right. In fact, I saw Rob less than a year ago, but I have not seen you for 7 years. And yet, you know, meeting up with you was like, oh, yeah, it's Max. You know, yeah. We talk every week. And it didn't feel like we hadn't last seen each other for 7 years.
Yes, yes. So we'll talk more about Sun and Fun a little bit later in this show. And we have some other recordings and interviews and things that we will provide to you all listening in the future, in the not-too-distant future. So you can look forward to that. But like I say, we'll talk about Sun and Fun a little bit more coming up. But first, let me introduce our guest. It's Amy Brower from the Champaign Aviation Museum in Urbana, Ohio. Amy is she does public. Amy, you do public affairs, donor relations, education. Sounds like you're sort of the person behind the scenes that does almost everything.
That would be, yes. And let me say thank you very much for inviting me to be part of your podcast.
Now, I ran into Amy, how long ago was that? A month ago? Maybe something like that. After I had been at the Air Force Museum in Dayton and looking for a place to grab some food that was more or less on the way home. What did I do? Well, we dipped into the Eat at the Airport Grimes.com site found Grimes Field Airport, and that has the airport cafe and also notes the museum right next door. So actually, Amy, when I arrived, even though I was hungry, the first thing I did was head right over to the museum. It's a spectacular place. It's a renovation factory as much as it is a museum.
Yes, and actually, within the next month or so, it will change even more as the 7,200 square foot workshop will open. So all of the tools and most of the active projects like the wings and the bigger things will move over there. So I actually will get to begin to start putting together more of a museum atmosphere in that larger building.
Ah, yes, because that was under construction when I was there. Sounds like they moved along pretty quickly, because I guess I wasn't expecting it to come together this quickly, but that's fantastic. That's great.
Yes, they broke ground in early November of last year, and it's a basic hangar building. There are no frills, but I also am surprised at the speed, because you mentioned the Air Force Museum. It takes them 15 years to build a new building. Yeah. I guess that's the difference between, you know, civil engineering or, you know, defense, whatever you want to call it, and actually private contractors.
Right, right. All right. Well, we're going to have a great conversation with Amy, learn about how you build a B-17 bomber and some other exciting projects that they have going on. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about the aviation news from the past week, or at least some of it. We'll probably go through this, I always say this, sort of quickly, if for no other reason than the fact that, I don't know, if Max T is as tired as I, as exhausted as I am, I don't know if we can talk too long about the news, but we'll give it a shot. So why don't we get started with the news? Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready in Philly.
Our first story, it comes from thisisinsider.com. Passengers on Southwest Airlines thought they were flying on a Boeing 737 MAX after confusion about their onboard safety cards. Interesting. How could onboard safety cards confuse passengers enough to think that they might be flying on a grounded airplane?
I can tell you, because I flew Southwest to Florida and back, and I saw exactly the same thing on my way out there, and I had exactly the same reaction initially until I read a little further. Obviously, some of these people didn't understand that there's a difference between the 737-800 and the 737 MAX 8, and they both share a common safety briefing card in the back pocket of every seat. And so when I first glanced at it, I saw 737 MAX 8, and I thought, what the heck?
Yeah.
And, I kept staring at it and opened it and looked around, and then I saw, okay, it also says above that 737-800. And I think a lot of people didn't notice that that's kind of dual-listed, and it caused a little bit of panic. So a lot of tweets on Twitter and a lot of posts from concerned passengers.
It seems like, under more normal circumstances, more fortunate circumstances, I guess, probably most passengers wouldn't have any idea, well, that they're even on a 737, let alone a Dash 800 versus a MAX 8 or MAX 9. But I think as a result of all this, everybody's quite aware of these airplane designations these days. But I don't know. I don't think that would be the case otherwise.
No, that's kind of unfortunate. There's an interesting picture that's also in this news story, and I don't know if it's shot from a helicopter or a drone or whatever. It appears it was shot from a couple hundred feet, and it shows grounded Southwest Airlines 737 MAX aircraft on the tarmac at what they call the Southern California Logistics Airport in Victorville, California. And I count 24 Southwest jets all parked next to each other. My recollection is that they have the largest portion of the 737 MAX fleet that's out there. And I know it's on the order of a few dozen, so I don't know if it's 24 or 36 or 48, but certainly this picture shows more than half of all of Southwest grounded aircraft in one place.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, besides the tragedy of the loss of life, which is in and of itself pretty horrific, I don't know, the the pain, the difficulty that Boeing and others are going through is really significant. And I mean, I don't think anybody is gloating over the fact that Boeing is in such this difficult situation. I hope it doesn't last too long, but we seem to be seeing more and more increases in the time that the fleet might be grounded. It's just really unfortunate.
Yes, there was a story out today that American Airlines announced that they're extending their groundings out through the first week in June. I can't remember, June 5th or something like that. So obviously, even the airlines that have all these airplanes don't know for sure when they'll get the final fixes from Boeing. And so they're just increasing, month by month, the date when they're going to bring these things back into service.
Yeah, yeah. Amy, do you run across people that have concerns about flying commercially in general, or any kind of reactions that you're picking up on?
I haven't. I don't really move in those crowds, I guess. So, no, the first mention I heard of it was today when I was meeting with the National Park Service. We were discussing the fact that I'm getting a presentation ready to go to Boeing to see if we can get some funds, since we've got four Boeing aircraft in Champaign Aviation Museum. And the comment was made, well, it's probably a good time for them to be, feeling more philanthropic.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. How that's interesting. How receptive do you find companies, the manufacturers in terms of supporting the museum that, has their products? I guess it must vary a lot from one company to the next.
Well, I know how generous they've been in the, the National Museum, the United States Air Force. The signs are all over the place. To be honest, Champaign has not truly approached Boeing to this point. And so they are top of my list. I like to go big or stay home. So again, because the B-17 is one of their iconic aircraft, an aircraft engenders a lot of emotions. And it was called the Flying Fortress, and appropriately, that aircraft could take a lot of abuse and still bring most of its crew home, as it did many, many times during World War II.
Yes. Well, one aircraft that I know you don't have in the museum is a Scaled Composites Model 401. And I wasn't terribly familiar with this, but as AvWeb reports in the secret airplane stops at FBO, this aircraft made kind of a bit of a public appearance. I don't know if that was intended or not.
I love this story. The Scaled Composites 401 is a drone demonstrator, Max.
Yeah.
It's got the shape of the Lambda wing, the V-tail, but it's optionally manned. It first flew in 2017, and it's been, I guess the best way to describe it is it's been conspicuously out in the open, but nobody really knows what's going on. And it stopped at the FBO because it was on its way transiting to Patuxent River to, I guess, get, as it was described by somebody, the petting zoo kind of look and feel to it. But yeah, you can imagine a stealth prototype pulling up to your local FBO and say, fill it. It reminded me a little bit of James Bond flying the BD-5J up to the gas station to fill it up. So we don't really know who owns it other than Scales Composite built it, but it's a demonstrator, but it's got technologies that we probably don't know about, and it was done on the cheap.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't part of a reportedly. One of the objectives of this aircraft was to create a demonstrator that had a low production cost. But it there's an article, it's an older article, well, I guess from last year in Defense News, that it has some dimensions for this. Max T, you saw that one?
I did. I've got it up right now. I was kind of intrigued by a number of similarities between it and the Cirrus jet that I'm type rated in. It is a single-engine aircraft, And of course, it's got a V-tail so that the thrust doesn't burn off the vertical stabilizer in the traditional tail configuration of most airplanes. It's got a little more power than the Williams engine on the Cirrus jet. That's around, just under 1,500 pounds of thrust. This is over 3,000 pounds of thrust from a Pratt & Whitney engine. And it'll go Mach 0.6 versus Mach 0.5. And I kind of guessed that it was single engine when I first saw the note that said FlightAware had tracked it at 230 knots. And I thought, that doesn't sound like a two-engine jet. Surprisingly, the wingspan's only 38 feet, which means it would theoretically fit into a standard T-hanger. So if somebody wants to pick one of these things up, they should be able to fit it in most any hangar at their airport.
Yeah, yeah. And you might want to take a look at the show notes for this, because there's some photos in there. There are actually a couple of videos out there as well, and we'll have links to all that in the show notes if you want to get a look at this 401 scaled composites plane.
And Mr. Trescott, why is the engine intake on the top of the fuselage and bled out through the tails? Let's see how military you think.
I have no idea, David. Go for it.
Infrared signature.
Yeah. Ooh, of course. Makes sense.
If you go back to the F-117, the V-tail of the 117 and the beaver tail were designed to reduce the infrared signature. For a slow-moving drone or a UAS like the Avenger or any of the new unmanned combat aerial vehicles, they have intakes above the fuselage to lower their infrared profile, and the V-tails reduce the signature from the ground and protect. So it's not really aerodynamics. It's more, as far as the military is concerned, it's less about aerodynamics and more about infrared signatures.
Sure. Minimizing radar cross-section makes total sense, since all those radar units are on the ground looking up. Might as well put the messy inlets on top of the airplane.
All right, moving on, aeronews.net. United warns flight attendants against illicit trip brokering. First time I read that, I thought it said tip brokering. No, it's trip brokering. And the airline has warned flight attendants that they need to stop the practice of trading or choosing flights that they'll work when there's some compensation involved. And I guess United is serious about enforcing that prohibition. I guess Max, it's a prohibition in their policies.
I think these kinds of trip trades have always happened to some extent. And I don't believe that United or any airline has a problem if two flight attendants decide, hey, I'm going to swap my trip for your trip. The problem is that apparently flight attendants who have seniority are able to bid and get really nice trips. Those would be ones that allow you to, you know, pack your hours into as few days as possible so that you're home more days out of the month. And then since those are valuable commodities, apparently they've actually been selling these desirable trips to their less fortunate colleagues who have less seniority but would still like to be home, you know, more days out of the month. So, yeah, United has kind of stepped up and said, let's not do that.
Yeah, I'm sure this will shut that down, I guess, for a period of time, or maybe just drive it deeper underground. I don't know. And some more news on WOW Air. In some ways, our favorite budget airline. Of course, we had Skooli Mogensen on the show, the CEO of WOW Air, some time ago. WOW Air has ceased operations.
Yeah, that happened about 10 days ago and left a lot of stranded passengers, though some of the other airlines stepped up and really were very helpful by coming up with kind of emergency special fares for people who were stuck at airports and needed to get back home and couldn't because their WOW tickets were now essentially useless. So it's great that the airlines kind of help each other out when things like that happen. I did notice just a day or so ago that Skooli was quoted as saying that he was looking to get WOW back up and running again So, you know, we'll see how successful he is on that. We've been watching this airline scale back considerably over the last few months as they were starting to have cash flow problems. Of course, they weren't able to, you know, fix that soon enough. I'm guessing it would take a major, you know, cash infusion. And, you know, I'm a little skeptical that, you know, having watched it fail under reasonably good management, that somebody would might be willing to say, oh, sure, let's roll the dice again. Here's, you know, tens and 20s millions of dollars to have at again. So we'll see. I mean, I think it just kind of tells us that the long-haul discount airline model is, you know, fraught with problems.
Yeah. And also, my perception of guys like Schooley who, you know, start an airline, is they're not of the personality type that's likely to have a setback or a failure, then pack it up, go home, and that's the end of it. And I'm sure we'll see him come back in some form or another, and whether it's you know, starting another airline or something else in aviation, you know, who knows? But I don't think he's done yet.
You know, I think you're right, and it's probably premature of me to kind of say, hey, it's not likely to work out. You are right. There are numerous serial airline entrepreneurs. I was listening to a podcast recently about David Needleman, who had started JetBlue and is now off starting yet another airline. So, yeah, I think when these people get airlines in their blood, they have difficulty stopping. They just want to keep doing it.
Yes, yes. All right, one more story. We talked about the Collier Trophy some episodes ago. This is, of course, the Robert J. Collier Trophy that is presented by the NAA, the National Aeronautic Association, each year. And what was it, Max? You kind of characterize it as what, like the Nobel Prize or something like that of aviation?
Very much so, yeah. Though it's an American prize, definitely. So it's only going to go, you know, typically to a company that's got some connection with aviation in America. But beyond that, yeah, I think it's a good analogy. A lot, even the folks at NAA will refer to it as the Nobel Prize of Aviation. And I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, we have had our picks in the past, and at times, you know, different hosts here at Airplane Geeks have correctly picked who the winner was. I think we got a big goose egg on this one.
We did.
I don't think any of our hosts picked the winner, so go ahead and tell folks who it is.
That's right. This was the Auto GCAS system, the Automatic Ground Collision Avoidance System. And they said this team, quote, successfully completed a rapid design, integration, and flight test of critical life-saving technology for the worldwide F-35 fleet. So, David, Auto GCAS, that was something that Lockheed Martin developed, I believe, in conjunction with the U.S. Air Force, the F-35 JPO, the Joint Program Office, as well as NASA, and the Defense Safety Oversight Council, kind of a team effort.
And it started with the F-16 program. The F-16 was the first one with the GCAS system. And basically it my brain just turned to mush.
It's like a collision avoidance system?
Well, it's to prevent purpose flying into terrain. What's the proper term, Max Trescott, that I'm missing?
Controlled flight into...
Yeah, controlled flight into...
Yeah, CFIT.
Yeah, what he said.
Controlled flight into terrain.
So, I mean, it's an alert system that the aircraft recovers earlier than a normal pilot should they lose control of the aircraft, and there might be a terrain thing. So it was very successful in the F-16 program, and they quickly moved it to the F-35 program. I got to admit, it's kind of nice that they picked the safety program as for the award, not just technology development, but in this case... This saves lives.
And there is at least one, I think maybe a couple of videos out there. We'll put a link in the show notes to one that's Auto GCAS Saves Unconscious F-16 Pilot. And this is some declassified U.S. Air Force footage. It's kind of dramatic. You're looking at the HUD, I think. I guess that's what you're looking at in this video.
Yes, you're looking through the HUD. Yep.
Yeah. And so I don't know what all that stuff is in the HUD. Trescott probably understands 14 times as much of that as I do. But in any event, the F-16 pilot is unconscious, and for I don't know what reason, but and is apparently about to impact on the ground, and you can hear the voices of others on the radio become, I think, increasingly more concerned, and then I guess what we're seeing is the system takes over and saves the pilot, saves the plane.
Yeah, what's remarkable is if you look at the altimeter, which is on the right-hand side, they were operating somewhere around 15,000 feet, and he went from 15,000 feet down to 5,000 feet in literally just a handful of seconds. I mean, wow. he was going down extremely rapidly, and I suspect that they had just performed some type of maneuver which pulled a lot of Gs, and that caused the pilot to go unconscious, and he probably would have been dead had the system not kicked in and leveled the aircraft off and then started to climb it back up. So I think it's an excellent choice, and it's just an example of how some of the new software-driven kinds of safety systems we have out there are really enhancing safety in aircraft. I see this all the time in some of the Cirrus aircraft that I fly with the envelope stability protection, which, for example, if you start to bank over to 45 degrees, the stick will then move you back to about 30 degrees, or if you pitch up too high, it'll pull forward to prevent you from a stall and things like that. These are all new kinds of things, certainly in general aviation in the past 7 or 8 years. But, all these little kind of things make a huge difference. And by the way, I just went back because I was – oh, go ahead. Yeah,
I was going to say, I'll dovetail off of that. All of these little things make a huge difference. It's not a very far removal thing from avoiding flight into terrain as an aircraft avoiding a stall automatically.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yes. I mean, it's interesting that this is a very successful program. And then we have the Boeing MAX, which has got kind of the same intention to override the pilots, and that has catastrophic effects. So it goes both ways, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because similar acronyms, GCAS and MCAS. I went and I pulled up the list of Collier Trophy winners for the past 10 years because I was thinking it's been a while since there's been a military contractor who has won. And sure enough, I was right on that. If you go back the last 5-6 years, it's been either things like the Cirrus Vision Jet, which won last year, Blue Origin, which is a space-related thing. Before that was the NASA JPL Dawn mission, which was the one that I voted for when I was on the selection committee back in 2015, the Gulfstream prior to that, and all the way back to 2013 is when the, and David will remember this one, the Northrop Grumman X-47B was the winner of the Collier Trophy.
All right, let's talk about the Champagne.
Let's talk about real airplanes.
The Champagne Aviation Museum. Now, I'm so glad Amy was able to join us. When I walked into that museum, so there's a lobby area, let's call it there, and there are actually a few interesting things in there, including that there's the ball turret is in the lobby, right, Amy?
It is, and since you were there, the extra B-17 engine is now in the lobby as well.
Oh, ooh.
Yes, I'm remodeling it. It's going to have its engine note along with it so that you can push a button and hear what it sounds like.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nobody in the lobby when I was there, so I just sort of pushed open the doors into the main hangar area, and yeah, it was amazing. I mean, you see a lot of aircraft there, and we'll talk about some of those. And you also see a B-17, which is in, well, I guess two major sections right now. And you see many, many people in there fabricating parts, assembling components, doing all kinds of restoration work. It's an active shop. So, Amy, tell us a little bit about, if you could, sort of the origins of the museum, what its major mission is. Give us sort of the background on the museum.
Okay, well, it's one man's dream. So in the summer of 2005, Tom Riley brought the B-17 Liberty Bell up to Grimes Field for an air show and was, of course, selling rides. And local businessman and private pilot Jerry Schiffer purchased a ride and was just entranced with the experience and was also struck by the enthusiastic support from the town. It was like the entire town of Urbana and surrounding areas was out to experience this B-17, you know, historic World War II aircraft up close. And as it turned out, something went wrong, and I beg your pardon, I can't remember what it is, but the Liberty Bell ended up staying for a couple of weeks while repairs were made. And so Jerry Schiffer got to have a lot of conversations with Tom Riley and the rest of the crew that accompanied the Liberty Bell. So a little bit later on, maybe a month or so, Tom Riley called the airport manager at Grimes because he had another project, another B-17G project that he had purchased, parts, including the fuselage. And he asked the airport manager if she happened to know anyone who might be interested in purchasing this kit, basically, to build this bomber. And that's how it happened. It was, you know, within 2 weeks, they had signed the contract agreement. Now, the sad part to this story is that November 29th of that very same year, the first shipment of parts arrives at Grimes Field, and Jerry Schiffer has taken off on a ski trip to Montana in his Cessna 425 Conquest, and he crashes near Belgrade, Montana, and is killed. So he doesn't ever see the completion or the beginning of the completion of his dream. And so the widow and the family decide that that's going to be his legacy, that they're going to see this project through. So the shipments continue to arrive, and they put them in a hangar there at Grimes Field. And the family business purchases the contract, I guess, you know, from some sort of follow-through from Jerry's will, I'm assuming. And then late in 2007, they decide they want to create a flying museum around this B-17 restoration project. So in 2008, they're granted the 501c3 status by the IRS. And also in 2008 was when the Schiffer family donates the funds to purchase the B-25, the Champagne Gal. And so that becomes the second asset flying at, well, it's the only flying asset, but the second aircraft into the museum inventory. And then in 2010, they built the building that you walked into. And so it actually, you know, they move into their official home from the hangar over on the Grimes Field. And now, as I said earlier, they're going to be opening the 1,700 square foot workshop, which will be nice. Because I don't know if you recall or not, Max, but the wings are hanging on the wall.
Yes.
There are several nacelles. I think there are four nacelles because we're building nacelles for the Liberty Bell at the same time. Because she had the fire in her engine. It's quite the story for someone like me who's more interested in the history. And of course, I specialized in World War II history and the Cold War in my college career to follow this journey, how this comes about. I mean, the volunteers in this museum are simply extraordinary, the things that they're doing. And what happened was they found that they needed to buy all sorts of parts. You know, they've got these pieces, but they're missing a lot. So it's like this elaborate jigsaw puzzle that's missing many pieces. And the parts are very expensive. They're cost prohibitive because no one's making them or, you know, salvaging them or, you know, going out to recover them from crash sites. So a new project manager joins the museum in 2008, just as they're thinking they need to buy tools, expensive tools, to be able to make these parts. And he actually teaches and trains the volunteers how to make the tools so that they can then make their own parts. So, and it starts with the fact that they found a radio room that they had pulled out of the water. So they take it completely apart. And while they're at it, they make two copies of it so that then they're not technically permitted to retail these parts because they don't hold the patent. American Airlines holds the patent for the Boeing B-17 design, but they're through donation made to the museum. So the next clever step is they go to the Smithsonian and purchase the microfiche with the complete set of blueprints for the B-17G. They pay to have them digitized. A volunteer takes the burdensome project of completely cataloging every single one of these parts. And I've seen the book. There's a lot of parts. So now they're completely, you know, digitized. So they're on computer. So you can look up whatever part you need and print out the sketch for that. And then they end up selling complete sets of these blueprints to other B-17 owners. So they basically recoup the cost, the initial cost of buying the microfiche and having it digitized. There's 25,000 plus of these drawings for these parts.
Wow. Yeah, as I was walking through and having some conversations with some of the volunteers who were fabricating some parts, some assemblies, I asked that question. I said, you don't have the original prints or anything, do you? And they said, oh, yes, let us show you. And it's just amazing to be able to have that available and to look at prints of the originals that give you all the specifications.
And they do. When they make one, they'll make double or triple or quadruple, because Champaign has now become the place for the other B-17 owners to come for parts. And as there's currently 10 of them still flying, there was 11, but again, the Liberty Bell's been grounded until she gets her new nacelle finished and put on. It's Champaign Aviation Museum is being very fair about the pricing and about the kind of donation that they ask, because it's become this collaborative sort of effort to keep these bombers, these iconic aircraft, flying and sharing them with the public. And as I said earlier, there's so much passion and emotion that surrounds this particular airplane. I mean, I see a lot of that in the Air Force Museum, but not to this degree, if that makes sense.
Tell us a little bit about the volunteers, the kinds of people. Who are they? Are they young or old, or have backgrounds in manufacturing? Or who are all of these volunteers?
They come from all over. We have doctors, dentists, former FBI agents, engineers. We actually have the son of a World War II combat vet. We have a Holland native who was retired from the Royal Dutch Air Force. His connection to the aircraft was, as a child, Operation Manichow Hound, where the 17s dropped tons of food over Holland. He remembers that as a young lad. So that's his connection. Of course, pilots. There's always pilots around. You know that.
Sure, yeah.
Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy, because now we have the new C-1A. That's the newest acquisition. Civil Air Patrol, we have teachers, we have mothers. We have a young mother with a homeschool lad, I think he's 10, who drives from Columbus now every Friday. And he's working on the aircraft, because you actually have to take a riveting test. You can't just walk up to this aircraft and start doing things, because the project manager is responsible for certifying every single part. I mean, he's the one who's licensed by the FAA to do so. So it's a very specific process. And the first thing I made was a gusset rib wing. I think I said that right. There's three words and I always get the order they appear messed up. But I literally went to the computer, printed out the sketch, went and got the metal, did all the cutting, did all the sanding, you know, and now it's part of the wing. And that is really, I don't know how to explain that feeling, to tell you that I am now part of that aircraft.
Yes. Had you ever built or created anything like that before?
No, I made the joke. I've not ever operated power tools other than a drill in my life, and I still have all 10 of my fingers.
Yeah, yeah. And now you've got parts on this B-17.
She is a conglomeration of five other B-17s.
Right. There was a recovery from, what was it, Alaska?
Yes, I spoke to that gentleman today. He's a very interesting gentleman. Do you know how that came about?
No. Well, explain that it was a crashed B-17 in,
yes,
in Alaska.
Well, and see, you can find the particulars of what they got from the B-17 and what it looked like out on the website. But me being me, I'm like, how did you know it was there? Who told you it was there? How did you know you wanted it? So this gentleman was in Alaska visiting his daughter and son-in-law, and he goes to Elmendorf Air Force Base to get his hair cut. And he's in the barber shop, and he sees this gentleman wearing a jacket with the Heritage Museum patch on it. And so they start talking about museums. And Paul, that's this Champagne Aviation Volunteer's name, tells him about the project they're working on. And the Alaskan gentleman says, well, you need to go out and get this airplane that's here that's crashed. And so Paul immediately goes and hires a helicopter, and they can't find it. They're trying to plot it on the map. They cannot find it. And of course, as he explains to me, helicopters are very expensive. They're like $2,000 an hour. So he comes back and makes contact with a bush pilot, as he calls it, and asks him if he's aware of this crashed B-17. And the bush pilot replies, sure, I fly over that every day.
Yeah.
So they go up, they go out, they see the site, and then he goes back to the helicopter because literally it's in this swampy area. So you have to be dropped in. He said the helicopter couldn't land. They literally had to get as close as they could to the ground and then hop out of the helo to hike to the site. And it's a really neat story because the entire community, including the Talkeetna Airport, donated so much of their tooling and their time to this recovery. The helicopter pilots donated the cost of the fuel. So something that was estimated to cost $250,000 actually ended up costing less than $40,000 because of the emotional connection that these bombers engender.
Yeah, that's fabulous.
It is fabulous. And so that particular bomber did not see any combat in World War II. It was a firefighter. And apparently the engine blew up and the pilot managed to land it in Alaska. And I think they only lost one crew member. So that was its story. But all of the other aircraft, there's a book called Final Cut about all the B-17s in existence.
Good book.
You have that, yes. David?
Does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all.
No, but let's go, as our friend Launchpad would say, yeah. Let's get geeky. There's two aircraft that I really love, and that's the Stinson and the Fairchild. If you talk about World War II Civil Air Patrol, the Fairchild F-24 is probably one of the sexiest aircraft from the 30s ever. But the Stinson also are really important aircraft for the war at home. And I'm glad you guys are working on preserving that aspect of it besides the B-7. You know, the bombers always get all the glory, but the really cool stuff is things like Stinsons. And of course, I'm a fan of the C-1. I have one living in my backyard for all intents and purposes. But Miss Liberty.
Excuse me? What?
I have one living within 2.5 miles away from me.
Really?
At the Delaware Valley Historic Aircraft Association at Willow Grove. They have a C-1 trader.
Huh. I call her the ugly girl between the two beautiful ladies because she's not that attractive. not next to the 25 and the 17. It's not her fault.
Well,
you and I share the Fairchild. I love that aircraft. I'm currently engaged in an active argument with one of the chief pilots. He told me that they've already given me my first flying lesson, and they keep trying to get me to become a pilot because there's so few women pilots, right?
Yes.
And I said, only if I get to fly the Fairchild. I absolutely adore that plane. It's gorgeous. It's red and white. And do you know who it belonged to, our particular one?
No, I don't.
Mary Pickford and her husband,
who
apparently his name was Buddy. He was not very good at flying it. He crashed it most of the time. So Tom told me that I would not be allowed to fly that until I had 400 hours. And I said, Tom, I'll be dead by then. I told him, I said, I won't get my pilot's license unless you let me fly that aircraft.
But at least have you gone up in it?
No, not yet. They're working on the annuals right now. So
you need to grovel and at least get up in it. We have one that comes into Mid-Atlantic Air Museum's World War II weekend every year that it was an official search and rescue aircraft and actually dropped bombs on a submarine off the coast of Jersey. So those are the museums.
The Fairchild did?
Yep. They did it for Civil Air Patrol.
Because our Stinson did. Our Stinson's painted in the Civil Air Patrol colors, and it still has the attachment on its wing where it would carry the bomb.
Yeah, no, the Fairchilds also did it, believe it or not.
I didn't know that.
See, that's why you come on these China shows. But no, I mean, but it's, I like, for all of those people out there, I'm going to preach. I'm going to lay it on the line. Like I've told the gang down at the Smithsonian every year, there are more aircraft at the Udvar-Hazy Center than the SR-71 and the Space Shuttle Discovery. You need to look left, you need to look right, and spend some time dealing with the little stuff in the corners, because that's the stuff that you're going to find really interesting and really loving. B-17s are amazing, B-25s are amazing, A-26s steal my heart, but something like a Fairchild or a Stinson that tells you a story more than probably a B-17 is probably a good thing. And it sounds like you're getting quite a collection at Urbana.
Well, I agree with you 100%. And this is what I'm trying to, and I'm going to say, I feel like, you remember the Three Stooges when he would knock all their heads together and it would make that coconut sound?
Yes. That's, yes, well, yes.
If you can imagine, of course, I'm surrounded by pilots and most of them male. And so I remind them that our new mission statement that I gave them is touching lives by restoring history, not touching lives by restoring a B-17.
Mm. Yay!
Yes, yes, she does. Thank you for saying that. I'm going to bring you with me next time, David, so that you can perhaps make that coconut sound with their pets.
Two things. I have a background in museum curation, and a good museum has a focus. Unfortunately, aviation museums, a lot of times they don't have a focus. And what they get is, well, somebody shows up with an airplane and they take it and then they don't know what to do with it. And it doesn't do that aircraft justice and it doesn't help the museum. So all of that, I mean, a good, coherent, curated museum is great. And what sounds great about your museum is to be able to go and watch them restore it. I was last month, or 2 months ago now, hard to believe, out in Hawaii, and they have the B-17E Swamp Ghost, which they've restored. But you can see the background. You can see the people working. You can, and young people can get really motivated to, wow, what's it like? Like you said, you popped rivets.
That's
an awesome experience. And kids need to see that, you know, their STEM, it's great, but there's also a lot of jobs out there that require to working with your hands and, you know, getting a little greasy and, you know, being a grease monkey and all of those kind of aspects that a lot of museums tend to gloss over. You know, nobody's going to restore like the Air Force Museum. Nobody's going to restore like the National Air and Space Museum. But then again, you hardly get to see what they're doing as far as restoration. In this case, you've got the ability to provide a hands-on experience or at least an up-close and personal experience.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm getting off my high horse now. Sorry.
No, that's good.
Okay. You've got a receptive audience here, I assure you, because you use the word museum. And I've told them, some aircraft in a building don't make a museum. That's not what makes a museum. It's the story you have to tell. It's, you know, the education that you're going to provide. It is all of those things that make the museum. I agree with you 100%. Ask me how many times at the Air Force Museum, the guests come in and lament over the fact that the Air Force Museum did not get a real shuttle. But this model that they have that you can get onto that's full scale and appreciate the size of the orbiter and look inside the crew compartment trainer and see all of the switches and the multi-billion dollar hygiene station, that's worth much more than a multi-billion dollar paperweight.
Amy, you and I are going to have so much fun going forward.
I always talk about the fact that the Air Force Museum was crushed that they didn't get a real shuttle. But in all fairness, they're in the middle of nowhere. As far as accessibility, and NASA wanted as much punch as possible. And they weren't going to get their first choice because NASM got their first choice. But the shuttle simulator and the crew simulator that's there is an impressive addition to that hangar and supports the Air Force mission, you know, and it gives other opportunities for other places to come up with something, because the Air Force Museum is the Air Force Museum. It's going to be that way till the end of time. It's designed to be a point of reference for all United States Air Force military aircraft as far as the Air Force is concerned since its inception, plus the enemy aircraft it fought against. So the shuttle sort of doesn't fall into that mission.
No, it doesn't. You're absolutely right. And thank you for that, because the Air Force exited the shuttle program in the late 80s, yes, because they weren't big enough to carry what they needed. They went back to the rockets. But everybody, that's one of those icons, again, that people associate or recognize quickly, I guess is the word I'm looking to use. But I was actually just, I hate to veer off the subject, Max, but I was actually very privileged my first year as a volunteer there to entertain a lady from NASA who she never really told me what she did, but I do know that she attended every single shuttle launch and landing and still was well known within NASA. And she would hear the guests make this comment and she would give them an earful. And she actually had, I had an amateur photographer take photos at her request of all of the research and development planes. You mentioned the X-47 and, you know, the shuttle, and she took those into NASA, and NASA was thrilled with our exhibit. And that's a big compliment in my mind.
Yes. Yes. Well, Amy, as I recall, when I was there at the museum, there are a number of events that the museum holds and participates in other locations, I guess. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about those.
You mean the air shows?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the B-25 is participating in the Living History Flight Experience, which is a special limited category certificate from the IRS, which allows passengers. And so we all have to go to ground school training in order to be crew. There are 3 crew and 7 passengers. And so basically, she gives that, you know, experience of being able to fly in the bomber. And routinely, we let people in the museum get up into her cockpit or into the C-1A or whatever happens to be sitting on the floor at the time in the 17. But she goes, we'll be going to Tennessee this year to do New York, Illinois. Of course, Grimes has its own air show. The one place, interestingly enough, because you mentioned Oshkosh, she does not go is Dayton. She will not be going to Dayton because we're not permitted to let people ride her.
Hmm.
So, which is kind of a disappointment, but.
But you will be up in New York at Geneseo?
Yes.
Okay, because yes. I'm planning on being there too.
Yes.
Good, good. Okay.
And I'm hoping, Randy's actually working on the annual right now for the C-1A. I'm actually looking forward to riding in that because she'll be able to carry a lot of the stuff that we need to bring along with us, since most of the Bombay area and whatnot is meant for passengers in the B-25. So I was kind of looking, that's a neat aircraft. I actually got to sit in it. You sit backwards, which I didn't expect that at first.
Well, that's because, keep in mind, that's what happens when you go down a catapult. It also, if you were sitting forward on an aircraft, and most carrier onboard delivery aircraft do this, the C-2 currently does it. The seats do face backwards because when you hit the carrier deck, you go forward. You don't really want to get slammed into the back seat as you hit the deck. So that's why they're always facing backwards.
That would make sense. Thank you for explaining that. That would make sense because you'd probably not be good for your neck, would it?
No, not really.
So it's really kind of exciting because of the amount of hours. I mean, the volunteers over the last 5 years have put in over 115,000 hours. And that's just since the executive director started having them log in. So that started in 2014. So who knows how many hours from 2000 2006 to 2014 were put into this aircraft. But she's the lady's to the point where it's now become fine piece work, I guess, for lack of a better word. And without a hangar, we're going to get to a point we can't go any further. There's no room to put her wings on. So that's our newest sort of challenge, I guess, is, and that's why I told you Boeing is at the top of my list. Because the C-47, that's a Boeing now. They bought, it just went right on my head, Douglas. Yeah, McDonnell Douglas. They bought them, right? Yes?
Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunately a Boeing C-47, yes.
Yes. And didn't they buy Mitchell as well, or is that one of the other ones?
No, the B-25 is also Boeing, because Boeing purchased North American. Well, North American got purchased and went through and then became part of Boeing. So Boeing, there are Boeing Mustangs and there are Boeing B-25s. And yes, it's discouraging.
Well, much like you, I love the fact I understand the A-26s are rare. Is that true, David?
They are. And really, well, anybody, A-26s, they're not really rare, but they're as rare, there's not as common as the B-25, but they are fairly common as a warbird. And the reason why, interesting enough, this will dovetail to your conversation about your B-17 parts. B-25 survived a lot after the war because they were used as executive transports and trainers. So there were a lot of them that went surplus after and didn't get cut up and scrapped. A-26s survived the fight in both World War II, Korea, and then Vietnam. Special K, which is a B-26K that was just restored and was, grand champion last year at Oshkosh, fought in Vietnam. But those aircraft, a lot of them went into the firebomber world. All you have to do is watch Always, the movie, the lead aircraft that gets Mr. Dreyfus into heaven is an A-26 Invader that's painted a lot similar to your yellow one. So the firebombers saved the A-26 fleet. So there's a lot of those that became warbirds and got restored. So anything to put a Pratt & Whitney or a double Wasp in, right, Max?
Of course, yes. I understand the engines for the B-17 are all done. They're all overhauled and ready for the wings. Is that right?
They are.
Yeah.
They are. The nacelles are the ones that they're working to complete now. And like I said, because one of them goes down south. So, and then we have the extra engine, which I told you is now in the lobby. I painted its container and I actually came up with the idea of rigging some wire around it so people can actually still touch it. Because again, that's a mission statement. You know, it's about touching these things. So it's a pretty piece of equipment. I like it.
I need to plan a trip to Ohio, I think.
Yeah.
Well, you do. I would love to have you because, like I said, I need some of that coconut noise. These pilots, they just, you know, it's about more than one aircraft. It's about all of the aircraft. It's about what they did. And we are so fortunate to have so many World War II vets. Over the last several years, of course, their health has deteriorated. But we have one World War II vet that is there every Saturday. He's 95 years old. He's a tail gunner. He completed 35 missions. He shot down 3 Germans, one of them an ace. And he still drives his own car. He still lives by himself. And he comes in, and just to watch him talk to, you know, young people is just, you know, amazing. I mean, he's a walking, talking relic, and it's his favorite thing to do. And my associate, Frank, has just finished, as of Friday, the tail gunner assembly. So it's all ready to go. It's finished. He was restoring that because his father was a tail gunner who was shot down in France and became a POW for a while. So that was why he had been working on that particular project.
See, this is kind of the flavor of this museum that I got when I visited. Well, that plus, as it turned out, I was there around lunchtime, and everybody decided they were going to head off to that airport diner that kind of drew me to Urbana in the first place. And you know, they invited me over, and we all had a a nice lunch together. But it's just this, there's this feeling of participation, of sort of communal passion, something like that. That's what I found when I went into that museum and just randomly started, you know, talking to people I ran across. I mean, including you, Amy, and others as well. It just has a completely different feel from any other museum that I've walked into.
I think that's a good way to put it. It does, and the ingenuity in there. For example, heat treating is a very expensive process. I'm sure you're all aware of that because you're all airplane experts. And they were spending thousands of dollars on heat treating. Well, we have a heat treating oven, but it's only a 4-foot oven. So if you're thinking about those long, wing spars, is that the right term?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the volunteers figured out, he takes and cuts the metal. He rolls it into rolls, almost like a cinnamon roll. He heat treats it. They made molds, and they have 45 minutes to unroll it and mold it, and saving thousands of dollars. Just that kind of ingenuity, that, you know, commitment, that investment in this project. It's just amazing to me what they think up. And they're actually, he's shown me parts of the aircraft that are actually made better than the original aircraft design. And I looked at him, I said, "You can do that?" And he's like, "Yes." He's like, "Yes, because we'll be flying it. We want it to be, you know, more sturdy." So where the two pieces of fuselage come together, Max, you know, where they're apart right now, there's an extra, they put in an extra metal, like lip, I guess, for lack of a better word, so that when they attach together, it'll be reinforced.
Ah. So where can our audience learn more about the museum?
Well, come visit, because that's the best part, and you might get to build something. Otherwise, it's the website, champagneaviationmuseum.org. So there's a YouTube, there's a live feed. You can watch with the volunteers. Right.
Yes.
So, and of course, donate, because I very much would like to have, I call it her room, because, sorry, David, but, you know, it's about time for those, start thinking about those wings being put on her. That would let the A-26 come inside, too, which is also on my list. I hate to see them outside like that. So we would have room for the A to come inside and get worked on. And also, I was very excited that they let me convince them to start working on the C-47. We can actually get her back in the air faster than we can get the B-17 finished, which is great.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. Well, really interesting conversation, Amy Brower. I'm glad I ran into the museum. I'm glad that I met you, and that you were able to come on the show and kind of, you know, spread the message of what the Champagne Aviation Museum is all about. So thanks so much for that.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate meeting you interesting gentlemen.
especially David. I think David is the most interesting gentleman among us. But what do you think, Trescott?
I can't disagree.
Okay. All right. Again, Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, the big topic on What's Up with the Geeks is our adventures at Sun and Fun. Max Trescott, you've been a number of times before over the years. For me, it was the first visit to Sun and Fun. And I have to say, it was really an amazing event. Got to meet lots of folks, some of them new folks that I didn't know before, some of them people that I knew but had never met before. And I got, David, I went flying. I went flying in a Pipistrel motor glider, which was really, really exciting and interesting experience. It's really something, you know, when you leave the earth under prop power, get up to altitude, and then turn off the motor, feather the prop, and just glide from there. It's kind of a neat experience. And Max, you went up in that Pipistrel after I did as well.
I did. Yeah, that's a really fascinating aircraft. It's the Cenis, And of course, Pipistrel has just sold their 1,000th aircraft, so they're doing fabulous there. And what's to me was most noteworthy about this aircraft was the exceptionally long wings. It's about a 50-foot wingspan, but you can pull off, or with a tool, you can remove the outer 5 feet of each of the wings, which brings it down to something like 39.5 feet, which would just barely put it into a standard 40-foot hangar. So I thought that was kind of a interesting design, which makes the aircraft a little bit more useful for people. But what was amazing was with those long wings, when you shut off the engine, it has a 27-to-1 glide ratio. Compare that with a Cessna 172, which is about a 7-to-1 glide ratio. And boy, we came down really slowly. At one point, we were probably, maybe 6, 7, 8 miles away from the Lakeland Airport at 4,000 feet. And the pilot said, oh, yeah, we'd have no trouble gliding to there. Typically, I'm used to, when I'm looking at a point that I can glide to, it's probably, somewhere within a 45-degree angle down from the aircraft. In this case, it was practically on the horizon. So that was pretty remarkable.
Yeah. When I was up the pilot, we did a 2G wing over, and then he handed the controls over to me, and I was the only fear I had is that he was going to have me do a wing over like that. And it's like, no way I was going to do that. I mean, I was not ready to do that on my own, but otherwise, I did some maneuvering and glided around and did pretty well. So it was really really cool. Really want to thank Pipistrel for giving us that opportunity. Another thing we got to meet Nikki. Now, if you've only started listening to Airplane Geeks, well, relatively recently, in the last year or two, you may not know, but Nikki was a student pilot, and she sent us reports to sort of document her progress towards getting her pilot's license. And so it was really fabulous to meet Nikki, and she's continued her flying. She kind of lives for flying these days. She's active in the Civil Air Patrol and doing all kinds of things. So she was a volunteer as part of the Civil Air Patrol presence. They have cadets and others that I don't know, what would you call it? They man the runways, or they provide safety for the aircraft coming and going. And Max, I don't know if you knew this, but Sun and Fun presented Nikki with a safety award, because it turns out that last year there was an incident where a guy was approaching a spinning propeller and apparently didn't realize what was happening and what was going to happen to him. And
thanks.
Yeah, and Nikki sort of sprung into action, and she says the people around that witnessed this say that this guy came within about 3 feet of the propeller, and if Nikki hadn't gotten there and done what she did, that he'd be dead. So they gave her an award for that, so that was pretty cool.
Wow, that's a remarkable story. I had not heard that.
Yes, it was out towards the end of the not the Warbird. Yeah, I guess the Warbird area. But in fact, she showed me some plastic fencing that they now have up there to provide a barrier, just because of that incident. So they they made that change. But it was great being at the radio station. A lot of aviation podcasters there. A ton of aviation podcasters were there. Got to meet a lot of great folks. The Valeris, both of the Valeris, lots of other places, lots of other people, Dave Abbey, and just so many people that it was just a great experience. I had a terrific time. One thing that, because people kept asking me, because it was my first time at Sun and Fun, kind of what my big impression was, and one of my characterizations, I think, of the experience overall is that I love attending weekend air shows, and I'll typically go both days. But still, even over 2 days, you feel kind of constrained by the schedule. If there's something going on, that you want to catch, you've got to be there, because that's it. That's the opportunity. Whereas with a week-long show, it's a much more relaxed, different kind of atmosphere. I mean, with the Blue Angels performing on four different days, if you're in the middle of a great conversation with somebody and miss the Blue Angels performance, it's not a big deal because they're flying again tomorrow and you could just go then. I thought that really changed the sort of the pace of the, you know, of the time there and the, you know, your ability to do many, many different things and still be able to do everything.
It's a really nice show. And I think one of the nice things about it is it's a little bit more compact than the larger show to the north, which makes it a little bit easier to get around. I found that I was carrying at times a fairly large pack because I was giving presentations every day, and you know, I had to get from the parking lot to where I was giving my presentations, and it was pretty easy to hitch a ride almost every leg of the way with either a golf cart passing by or with the trams. And so I would say there's a little bit less walking than at the really big show. In fact, there was one humorous incident I know you recall. The very first day that I was there, you, Rob, Mark, and I were going to meet for lunch at the Sun and Fun radio location. It was going to be around 12:15, and I was worried that I might be a few minutes late, and I saw a golf cart go flying by me, which then came to a stop because there was a cart blocking it in front of it. So I'm behind the golf cart, and I said, "Hey, can I have a lift?" And the driver turns around and goes, "Yeah." And then he did a double take and looked around and goes, "Max, is that you?" And of course, it was Rob Mark.
Yes.
So we were both rushing there to meet each other, but we arrived at exactly the same time.
So funny. it was pretty funny.
But, you know, I found it was fun running into people that are from California that I don't see except at places like Sun and Fun and other large air shows. So that's pretty funny. It's kind of interesting that, you know, some of these people don't live more than, you know, 20, 30 miles from me. Yeah. But I never see them out here. I see them out there. So those are some of the connections I enjoy making when I'm there. I gave presentations every day. One day, two seminars. One was my night flying safety seminar. And the other was a new one that I've put together called So You Want to Fly or Buy a Cirrus. And, of course, I mentioned the Aviation News Talk podcast at the beginning of the seminars. And the seminar on Saturday for the Cirrus, early on, I said, "And how many people have ever listened to the Aviation News Talk podcast?" More than half the hands went up. And I thought, whoa, I had never seen that before. Usually it's just barely half the hands that have heard what a podcast is. But I was really thrilled that a lot of my listeners came out for that particular podcast. So, yeah, it's kind of for that particular seminar. So it is kind of fun to run into listeners. A lot of listeners, sent me texts and emails, and we met up with a few of them, and it was quite enjoyable. Now, speaking of highlights, there's one that I'm surprised you didn't mention. Where were you viewing the Blue Angels on Friday?
Well, on Friday, for that particular Blue Angel demonstration, I was actually up on the balcony around the top of the airport tower. So I had a command view of the Blue Angels demonstration. It was really, it's different. It's a different perspective when you're up high like that. For one thing, you can see farther to the, figuratively, to the right and left. So in other words, after they make a pass over center field, of course, they can continue on and they have to, form up or regroup, and you can see a lot more of what they're doing out in the distance out of your view if you're down on the flight line watching. So that was pretty interesting. So, and you almost made it up there.
Well, I did make it up there, but I wasn't able to stay for very long. Yeah, we have kind of a comedy of errors. I didn't know that you were headed there, and once I found that you were there, I headed over there, and they let me in through the gate because I said I wanted to join my podcaster friend at the top there. I got up to the top, I looked all over, didn't see you, and they said, "Okay, let someone escort this gentleman back down again." Yeah, I think my mistake was not saying that I was part of the media, since we had our media passes there. Lo and behold, I couldn't see you because you were on the balcony outside. So it was only once I got back down and had left the gated area that I discovered through either a phone call or text message that, hey, I was within a couple feet of you.
Yes.
But the thing that really struck me about the view from up there is that the Blue Angels look like they're substantially at eye level. Was that your experience?
Yeah, yes. And
And you'll quickly learn that the Blue Angels don't necessarily look like what you're supposed to look like when you're down on the ground.
Yes, it is different.
A lot of the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels, okay, this is how dorky I am and how many times I've seen them is, from various other angles other than show center, the formations don't look anything like what you see. So the Diamond Pass in review, they are in a formation that makes it look like the Diamond Pass in review at show center ground. If you're up high or farther down range or maybe in line with the end of the runway, you're going, what am I seeing? And so you get a different perspective of
the angle
illusions, the illusions that the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds play.
Yes. I mean, it's not to take anything away from the flying skills at all.
No, absolutely not. But they do use that.
Yeah. And I think they do the same with the noise, because the sound patterns were in some cases a bit different. So I think that not only do they fly in patterns and in ways that impacts the sort of the visual impression of it, but I think they do the same with the engine noise. Or another way to put it, maybe more simply and directly, is I think they sort of throw the exhaust at the crowd so that you get the maximum effect of the sound of the engines. But yeah, that was spectacular.
And it looked to me like the tower was actually a good place location-wise. You're probably, I would guess, at least a third of a mile from show center. And yet there were many times when all the aircraft were, passing each other right there next to the tower. It was almost like some of the maneuvers looks like they were being put on for the benefit of the air traffic controllers. And by the way, we kind of estimated that tower was roughly 120 feet. So it's a pretty tall tower, and it was a great, great, vantage point.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned before, we have some great interviews. I'm still exhausted from the week, and so I won't be able to think of all of them. But a few of them, we have the executive director who helps explain that Sun and Fun. This is a campus where a lot of activities take place throughout the year. This is not a situation where everybody comes in for 1 week for an air show, then everybody goes home and then comes back again 1 year later. There are significant educational and variety of activities that take place throughout the year. So we talk about that. I talked with a teenager who, in order to fund his flight training, created a company and sells related products. So we'll look forward to hearing that. And just some other interesting interviews. Oh, I ran across a family. They have a family business of doing GA aircraft, primarily GA, not exclusively actually, but primarily GA aircraft interior restorations and, custom interiors. So they work with the pilot to pick fabrics and pick colors that complement the airplane and the effect that the pilot's trying to achieve. And they pride themselves in the quality of their work, but also in being able to turn it around quickly so that the pilot's not without plane for too long. So we had an interesting conversation with them and a number of others. And as I said, we'll be bringing those to you in the coming weeks.
So what do you think? Same time next year?
Same time next year, no doubt about it.
All right.
I also, one other thing, I know I could go on about this. I was just so, I'm still on the high from this event. I drove from Connecticut to Atlanta, and I spent Sunday night with dispatcher Mike's family. He's got three kids. They're wonderful kids. And then the plan was to fly down from Atlanta to Lakeland, Florida for Sun and Fun in his 1963 Beech Musketeer. But Mike woke up Monday morning sick as a dog. He had a fever, and there was no way he was going to be able to fly. He shouldn't be flying. So I said, well, I guess I'm going to drive the rest of the way to Florida. Now, we were going to camp out with his plane. He had the tent. I'm on my way to Florida suddenly now, so I had to stop and buy a tent. And I'm thinking, you were in a hotel, Max, but yeah, my idea of camping is pull up the Hilton app and find a place. So I wasn't really terribly looking forward to sleeping on the ground. But you know what? That is a big part of the experience too, is the people you meet, the conversations that happen, the friendships that are created just by living in a campground with a bunch of other people. So I'm not sure if I want to get a hotel next year or if I'm going to camp next year. But in any event, I will be there next year. I also told the folks at the Sun and Fun Radio, who are an amazing bunch, by the way, that I'm going to hopefully become a volunteer next year to help them out and kind of contribute, give back some more.
Hmm. That was definitely a fun place to hang out. That was really essentially the main meeting place for Max and me when we were there, as it was for a number of other podcasters and the volunteers there. Dave Schallbatter and his team are just very warm, welcoming, and we felt like we belong there. And so that was it was nice. And of course, it's a very central location, so it was a good place to hang out and be in the shade a little bit and have some fun folks to talk with and a place to sit down and things like that. So yeah, it was definitely an awesome experience. One of the things that I heard, and I don't know all the details on this, and you probably got this from the director, something I hadn't known before, but apparently all of the profits from Sun and Fun plow directly into aerospace education kinds of activities. What more do you know about that?
Yes, actually the week-long Sun and Fun fly-in and expo is the major source of funding for all of these educational opportunities that they provide throughout the year. So it's that's how it's viewed. They actually have, and you'll hear all this, but they actually won an award for the degree to which, and this is my terminology. You'll hear the proper terminology in the interview, but for the way they leverage the fly-in and the air show and the way they leverage all of the educational opportunities that they provide. I mean, you'll hear about how many pilots have been created, as a result of this, and the impact on students from the area and so forth. So they've got some recognition, and other air shows around the country frequently come to benchmark Sun and Fun to learn how do they use this great asset to educate more, create more pilots, and do all these things that you want to accomplish. So it really is an amazing thing. That's a great interview coming up.
There's one other aspect that things have changed. I hadn't been to Sun and Fun for probably about 6 years, and when I was last there, presentations given by folks like me were done in tents, and I thought that's what it would be like again this year. And I was quite surprised to find out that all of our presentations were indoors. Most of them were at a place I was not familiar with, and that's the Central Florida Aerospace Academy. And this is pretty remarkable. This is essentially a high school with a focus on aeronautics and aviation. It's a rather large facility. Let's see, I think it was 3 stories tall, a lot of classrooms in it, and I was essentially teaching in a classroom. I felt like back to high school with the kinds of desk there and the bulletin boards and stuff like that. So that's a rather unique asset. I'm not aware of any other school like this anywhere in the world, but pretty amazing that for folks interested in aerospace and engineering, they can go to a high school that's geared right toward them.
Yes, yeah. Instead of thinking of this as an airport or as a big campground or as lots of fields, the way to think of it is it's a campus. It's a campus, and it happens to have runways and a control tower and schools and a museum and all of these things. So fascinating stuff. The only negative I would say is connectivity. In many cases, even text messages took half an hour to go through. That was kind of a problem. So I bet we have tons of great listener feedback at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. But honestly, I haven't even looked at it. So for those of you who have written in hoping to hear us respond to your emails, you'll have to be a little patient as we get kind of caught up with that and get a little more sleep than we've been having in the last week. Before we close out, anything else that we want to touch on?
Well, can I do my what's going on with the geeks?
You know, David, it would pale in comparison. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Micah tweeted out the other day, and Micah, you kept me up all night.
Oh, no. What did Micah tweet?
Well, he retweeted the fact that he didn't realize that a certain aircraft that he said someone near and dear to him would know that there was at least 57 variants of.
Hmm.
And the person near and dear to him was me, and the aircraft they were referencing was the C-130. So, Micah, I decided to give you a little research project since I was up all night thinking of all the variants. So, as of right now, you need to do the following. Hopefully, you're ready to dictate this and writing this down.
So, these are variants of...
These are... Okay, I'll be specific. They are non-transport variants of the C-130, and they are only United States Air Force or Navy variants or Marine Corps. There are no foreign variants in this list.
Okay. And what's in the list?
Well, here's the list.
Okay.
Here's the variants for all you to research, Micah. The ABCCC, the Combat King, the Combat King II, the Combat Shadow, the Combat Solo, Combat Spear, Combat Talon 1 and 2, Commando 2, Commando Solo, Compass Call, Credible Sport, Dragon Spear, Ghost Rider, Gunship 2, Harvest Hawk, HC-130H Crown Fulton, Pave Pronto, Pave Spectre, Ski Bird Spectre, Spooky Stinger, Surprise Package, and last but not least, Fat Albert.
Did you create this list off the top of your head? I mean, you didn't. Did you look these up or did you know these?
No, I knew most of them, yes.
Yeah.
I double checked my other ones, but I think I missed Tacomo too. So, yeah, it's kind of like C-130s. It's kind of like the same list that, you know, name every aircraft the Thunderbirds flew and name every aircraft the Blue Angels flew.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, that's your little research project, Micah. So
very good.
I have the 30 or 40 books on the subject if you'd like to read them.
All right. Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Max T and I need some rest. Are you going flying tomorrow, Max?
Oh, I've been flying already today. I had about 6 hours of flight training. And by the way, I just pulled up a tweet that came through a day or so ago, and it was kind of timely because I had been, you know, teaching about the Cirrus at Sun and Fun from at Flight Notes on Twitter. He tweeted out, "Had a dream that I won a brand new Cirrus SR-22, and Max Truscott was helping me transition to it from the Warrior." Also, the panel had a built-in Nespresso machine, and he's got the tag of coffee here. Someone else replied and said, "The best part of waking up is an SR-22 in your cup."
Oh, wow. Oh, wonderful. All right, let's wrap this up. Amy Bauer from the Champaign Aviation Museum. Amy, thanks so much for coming on the show. Boy, we really look forward to seeing you. Are you going to be up in New York yourself?
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, then at least I'll see you there.
It's not that far for me either.
I know. You all should come, and I'll see if I can't wrangle a ride for you.
Oh, that'd be great.
Be careful what you say there.
Yeah.
Well, if you ask Max, who's met me, he knows that I can be quite persuasive.
Yes. Yep. I've already made my hotel reservations, actually.
Well, as I understand it, there's not that many places to stay, so I may be sleeping in a tent on the field like you did in Florida.
Yeah. Maybe I should have got a suite or something and rented a floor. That would have been great. So thanks for coming on the show. As always, you can find us on the web at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode are there as well, but if you want to go straight to them, they're at airplanegeeks.com/548. When I was at the museum, I took a bunch of pictures, so we'll put a few of them in the show notes. If you want to send us an email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And you can find us. The best thing to do is to subscribe to the podcast. That way you won't miss any episodes. And you can do that almost anywhere, any of the podcast apps, iOS or Android, we're in there. We're also in Pandora now. We have a growing Pandora population of listeners, also Spotify, as well as Stitcher and TuneIn. And let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And let's see, Max Trescott, let's start with you.
They can find me at the home of the Aviation News Talk podcast, where we talk about everything general aviation, and that would be aviationnewstalk.com. Just click on contact at the top of the page, or if you want to leave a question that I'll answer on the show, just click on listener questions.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me skulking around museums. You can also find me on our Slack listener team, which, of course, we want you to join and join the party. You can do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And you can also find me on the UAV Digest, which we just sort of released a little late. So this, check out this episode. It's kind of interesting. We had a very lovely replacement for Max this week. So
that's right.
That's the UAVDigest.com.
Great. And Amy, once again, tell our listeners the website for the museum.
That would be the ChampagneAviationMuseum.org.
Cool. And you can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight. Also with David at the UAVDigest.com, as he said. And with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro is by Bruno Masson. What? So, this is like the advance notice for those of you who have stuck with us through the whole episode. So, I made some interesting recordings of the Blue Angels performance. So, if you like engine sounds, and if this works, I might have something special coming up. So, listen for that. Maybe treat that as a little teaser. But otherwise, our outro is by Bruno Masson. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomasson.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments, we shall be landing. Kindly observe.
Kids, some class.
What are you trying to do?